Hello and welcome to the Guelph Politicast. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico. If this is your first time streaming or downloading the program, Guelph Politicast is an interview show where I talk to politicians, activists, and people of note making a difference or just trying to make life in the Royal City more interesting. For previous episodes of the Guelph Politicast, you can find them on the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean, or you can subscribe through iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. Today,
we're going to board the bus in 30 seconds. Brian and Marnie right here will be in front of, like, next to the doors, handing out the agenda and the package for the day today.
We will go on a bus ride, the Moraine Discovery Tour that was hosted by the Protect Our Moraine Coalition this past Sunday. The coalition has been one of the preeminent voices of skepticism about the City of Guelph's directions for the Claire Maltby secondary plan, so about 50 people accepted the invitation to take a spin around Guelph's south end to put visuals to the policy proposals, and so that people would know the land that's being debated about. Hearing me see Claire Maltby is the topic of this edition of the Guelph Politicast.
My name is Mike Marcolongo, so I'm with the Protect Our Moraine Coalition. First off is the South End Community Park, and then from there we'll start the tour.
The tour left the boathouse, journeyed to the South End Community Park off Clare Road West, and then continued down Crowley Road to Maltby, where the bus stopped to discuss the need to protect wetlands and wildlife in the plan. The tour then wrapped up at the Marcolongo Farm on Gordon Street. The tour was about 3 hours long, so some of the commentary has been edited in this podcast for brevity. So let's begin our tour.
I just wanted to point out that as you travel south, Gordon Street was extended to four lanes back in 1997. And what's happened is there was a huge investment in trees. $100,000 in trees was spent along this corridor. As part of that construction process. Or any tree that's in the, or was planted in the boulevard or in the median, on the edge, has not survived. But trees that are on the other side of the sidewalk, especially as you move north this way, have survived. So it's there's a lesson learned there in terms of viability for urban forestry if we're going to plant trees in boulevards.
The first stop is the South End Community Park, where behind the Ball Diamond, you can see the topography of the moraine quite easily. One of the other voices you'll hear on this tour is Val Wyatt, a member of Nature Guelph.
So which of the watersheds gets the most water?
Both the Mill Creek and the Hanlon Creek receive substantial, significant amounts. The Hanlon Creek is just in the Southgate Park business area, and Mill Creek is just north of, a line just north of Maltby Road. Everything south of there flows south.
Are you able to estimate how much of this moraine topography was farmland? This just doesn't look like farmland to me.
That's a really good point. And actually,
it's 72% is currently in natural or successional vegetation. So that leaves less than 30 in developed or agricultural situations.
The Kennedys were the original family here that farmed the land, and it was cleared of trees. As Val mentioned, this is a successional central forest, so it's coming back to forest. A lot of the pine trees were planted in the 60s and 70s to reforest the area. So we actually owe it to Scots ancestors here. The Scottish were modified the landscape significantly. Throughout Claire Maltby, you'll see significant amounts of stone piles, boulders like we see down here, and smaller rocks. And just backbreaking labor to turn this into agricultural land. Okay, so I'm going to speak to Protect Our Moraine Coalition. So we are a loose coalition of six organizations made up of Nature Guelph, Wellington Water Watchers, the Guelph Urban Forest Friends, the Architectural Conservancy of Ontario, Families for Rolling Hills, and the Foundation for Support of International Training. We came together because we had concerns about how the Claire Maltby secondary plan was moving forward. The secondary plans are typically aspirational, so they, as the great one said, I don't go for the.
I don't go to where the puck's been. I go to where it's going.
There you go. Thank you. So it should be aspirational in that aspect. It is the last 1,000 acres, so it's the last major greenfield area in the City of Guelph. And it has to be planned carefully because we're running out of land. Basically, it will define the infrastructure, so where the road, the sewers, the water is coming from. It'll define the land use plans, so what type of employment lands, what type of residential, what type of commercial. It'll define what type of transportation system will be prioritized. It'll define what we're setting aside for green space, and what we're protecting in terms of natural heritage. On the positive side, the city has a very strong institutional approach to protecting natural heritage, starting back in 1993 with the Hamlin Creek subwatershed study. So 38% of this land will be protected through the natural heritage strategy. I think the challenge at this point is the remaining 62%. How do we plan the remaining lands, and what happens to it, and does it reflect our values? And that's why we're here. The good news, and to give the city lots of credit here, is that the city is doing really well in terms of the growth planning. So at this point in time, the legislation suggests and basically tells municipalities intensification will be within the existing urban envelope shall be at least 40%, and any new development in Greenfield should be up to 60%. So there's a 60-40 balance there. The city does monitor its growth, and the 2017 Growth Monitoring Report suggests that intensification is much higher than 40% in the city of Guelph. It's at 62%. So within the existing urban envelope, we're seeing 62% of new development happening there for residential. So that's a real positive story. Municipalities such as Hamilton, which are also part of another growth community, they're below 30% for the last 4 years. So we're doing well in that way.
Well, you mentioned that 38% is in the natural heritage system, so I was just wondering what the percentage of the area is in provincially significant wetlands and associated buffers. So that would be mandated, yep, regardless.
Yes, it's my understanding that 10%, fully 10% of the area is wetland.
So I'm going to speak quickly to our first concern as the Protect the Moraine Coalition, which is parkland dedication, and give you some background on that. It's kind of timely that we are here in terms of there's a pretty phenomenal park. One of the challenges for parkland set asides for Claremalpi is because of the topography. Very undulating, and to establish a park of this caliber, obviously you need table land. And if we start mucking around too much with the topography, we're going to lose some of the heritage, natural heritage features and the natural heritage functions of the land. So, how much parkland is being allocated for Claremalpi? At this point in time, 18 hectares are being established, or a minimum of 18 hectares are assumed for Claremalpi. So that's 8 neighborhood parks and at 1 hectare each, and a community park at 10 hectares, which will be going past that site. It's at the corner of Gordon and Malpi. So again, total allocation 18 hectares. The challenge is, because it's a growth planning area, Claremalpi population projections are between 15 and 25,000 residents. So if we look at the official plan definitions, where it's a minimum of 2 hectares per 1,000 residents, that we're falling quite short. For 15,000 residents, as per the official plan, we would require 30 hectares at a minimum, at 2.0 hectares per 1,000 residents. The official plan has an aspirational target of 3.3 hectares per 1,000 residents, and that includes regional parks, community parks, and neighborhood parks. If we go for the aspirational parkland set aside, it would be closer to 50 hectares per 1,000 residents. The challenge here is that the development planning process doesn't allocate enough land for parkland. And staff are aware of that. They've told us that with the development planning approvals, they expect to be 1.2 hectares per 1,000 residents at most. So the challenge for the city is, how do we acquire additional parkland? There are tools. You can use Section 37 of the Planning Act. So there's, it's called density bonusing. So there's, if you build higher or wider or with more density, you're able to trigger what's known as community benefits, and parkland acquisition can be used for that. There's also cash in lieu, so often developments will have a cash in lieu feature. So the site is constrained. Developers will pay cash instead of setting aside parkland. The challenge is, again, how that money is used. So right now, the city doesn't have a policy how the cash in lieu funds are used. It could be used to improve a recreational center, or it could be used to acquire parkland. In 2016 and 2017, the city used $500 million of the cash in lieu fund to fund the renovations at Victoria Road. In my opinion, that's a depreciating asset. We should be acquiring more parkland because that's a requirement under the official plan. So those are some of the considerations. We've been having a lot of conversations with city staff in planning and parks about what we think is a lack of vision around parkland acquisition for Clare Maltby, and it's been a real going concern for us. So when we looked at the consultation document that was released on the 26th, we were disappointed, because I mentioned to you, staff did admit we're going to be shy of our targets under the official plan. We're going to hit 1.2 or 1.3 hectares per 1,000 residents. That's if we have 15,000 residents. If we have 25,000 residents, we're gonna be really short. And yet, in the consultation document on page 16, parks on number 7 is opportunities to increase the amount of parkland in Clare Maltby should be explored. To us, that's not a lot of vision. That's not a lot of. There's no policy framework on it. There's no discussion about how they plan to do something about it. And this is the challenge for us. We have a plan here, and you've got the community structure plan in your hands. The policy is following behind. There's not a lot of proactive, strategic approaches to how we're going to get there.
The bus then left the park and drove west on Clare Road, and as we turned onto Crawley Road, Emerge Guelph Executive Director Evan Ferrari wanted to draw everyone's attention to a specific landmark.
Just wanted to point out to the hydro substation on the left. There's another set of fences here. You'll see some very low slung concrete. Just keep going a little further, please. See these gray buildings up ahead? On the other side of these gray buildings, look close to the ground, and you'll see these concrete circles. There are 10 of them. Can you see them? See the concrete circles behind you?
Yeah.
So what they are is that's a 10 megawatt electricity storage test facility. Each one of them has something called a flywheel in it. And a flywheel, that's approximately 2 tons, if I remember the math correctly. But imagine a top, you know, a child's top, that it takes very little energy once it's going, very little energy to keep it going. Although that facility is testing that concept. So it takes a lot of energy to get it going. But once it gets going, just small spurts of energy keeps it going. But what it enables it to do is, in extremely small periods of time, like fractions of a second, of being able to put electricity back into the grid when there, for whatever reason, there are problems with it. There are about 6 different test facilities testing different types of storage systems at this scale, which is 10 megawatts. And to put that into context, on average in Guelph, we draw about 250 megawatts of power at a given time. So it's not huge, but from a test perspective, it's pretty significant. And that'll play into our energy discussion later.
So we travel down Maltby Road past 3 wildlife crossings. There's no signage there, so unless you know what you're looking for, you would never know that there was a place for small mammals, amphibians, and other animals to safely cross the street there. The impact on local wildlife is another concern about the development here.
We're now on Maltby Road west, and this road was rebuilt about 6-7 years ago. They did integrate 4 wildlife crossings under the road. We won't be getting off the bus, but I'm going to encourage you to look for them. We are approaching the first one at the bottom here. You can see the there's metal fencing on each side.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Okay.
And we're going to stop by the last one, and Val will speak to us about wildlife crossings.
So they go under?
Yeah. So they go under, and you see the metal grates. That's for light, so the animals are encouraged to use the wildlife crossings.
Oh, right. So if you refer to your community plan mapping that was handed out as part of your package, we're now at the south end of the secondary plan study area. I want to draw your attention to the areas mapped in green, both the dark green and the light green, and that is part of what's called the city's natural heritage strategy. It's about a decade old, and what this represents in the Clare Maltby area are significant woodlands, significant wetlands, and significant wildlife habitat. There are other components of the city's natural heritage system, which are ecological linkages and significant landforms, but it's mapped in a lighter green color. The dark green colors, development of any kind is prohibited in those. But in the light green color, essential infrastructure, so that's things like water mains, sanitary sewers, and roads are permitted in those ecological linkages and significant landform areas that are designated in the light green there. Now, as Mike mentioned earlier, there are two provincially significant wetland complexes in the area. We are now surrounded by pockets of the Mill Creek provincially significant wetland. And the city retained consultants to do all sorts of natural heritage work in addition to the hydrogeological work that was conducted. Here, they studied the movement of amphibians and reptiles such as turtles across this section of the road, actually at multiple locations on Gordon Street, both sides of Maltby, and where we are located here actually had the highest level, or shortly behind us, the highest level of amphibian numbers crossing the roads, even with these wildlife crossings in place. A lot of places without wildlife crossings were also monitored, and there are dozens, if not hundreds, of amphibians. So those are frogs, most commonly northern leopard frogs, peepers, American toads, green frogs. There are American bullfrogs throughout the study area, as well as midland painted turtles and snapping turtles. So there are numerous areas where, especially with the increase in traffic, wildlife mortality is a significant concern. There are designs, as you can see, for wildlife crossings under roads, but it's an area of evolving research. And the problem in Guelph is that we don't have a track record of successful wildlife crossings. There have been substantial studies done around the Clare Road East at Gordon, if you know the Galaxy Theatre there, at the intersection of Gordon and Clare. There's been quite a lot of work done there. However, not since the crossings on Poppy Drive have been completed. What they noted there were hundreds and hundreds of fatalities of frogs each year on Clare Road and a little less on Hawkins Drive next door. There are also wildlife crossings newly installed on Eastview Drive, but to the best of my knowledge, the results of those surveys have not been released or completed. This is, I guess, a second concern of the Protect Our Moraine group, is with all of the wildlife movement throughout this, between and amongst the significant features of this secondary plan area. Do we have the tools and technologies in place to successfully mitigate the impacts of increased traffic, of more roads put in, and of the movement that's already occurring here?
Before we move on, I do want to draw attention to the map. So you'll notice at the bottom of the map, there's a road jutting out on Maltby East. So this is approximately where the bus is right now. So the road that starts on just east of the parking lot we were in about 20 minutes ago, it comes out right here, right about here. So it's an entire new road that crosses this landscape. Just to put it in perspective, the land that is this fields, the cornfields here, are owned by Thomasville Homes. So Thomasville Homes has two significant land holdings in Clare Maltby, this property here, and as well as the Springfield Golf Course. And they're one of five or six major developers.
Someone asked about the Condo Canyon, the part of the secondary plan that calls for high density along Gordon Street. Doesn't this high density help mitigate environmental concerns about development here?
The challenge for us is the greenfield policies and the official plan call for urban villages. So we're suggesting to the city, let's build those villages so that those amenities are all in the same place, that we're creating nodes. If we build a condo canyon, one, we've lost community, and two, those amenities, whether they're employment lands, whether they're commercial opportunities to go shopping, the parks, they're not there. They're not close by. People will be using the automobile to get around. So it you know, the challenge is how do we build those nodes, those urban villages that the official plan policies are calling for.
Further down at the corner of Maltby and Gordon, there's a reminder that there's more at stake with the Clare Maltby secondary plan than just sustainability.
As we're traveling further east, I just want to point out this is owned. This land over here is owned by Fusion Homes. Well, it's actually it's going to be developed by Fusion Homes. It's owned by the Avila Group, and it was bought by Fusion Homes' father. So there's a convoluted relationship there. This is where the 10-hectare community park is slated for, and the developer is not in favor of hosting this 10-hectare community park. And in fact, their development consultant, who will really remain nameless, was suggesting to council and to city staff that instead of putting the community park on this side of Clare Maltby, that it should be appended to the existing community park, which we visited earlier on. Now, you can imagine the challenges of appending a 10-hectare park to the land that we visited when you look at the topography. So the city did, of course, push back. But what I'm trying to get to is there's a lot of money to be made or lost depending on the planning decisions in Clare Maltby. And the development community has consultants, and lots of them, that are trying to push for a certain approach and a certain agenda. And that's a key concern for us.
On Maltby East, the concerns about wetland sustainability were really well illustrated. On the north end of the road, the land has been developed already, and on the south end, the wetland remains in its natural state. Marcolongo and Wyatt pointed out to the tour that there may be unexpected demands on Guelph's water resources that the secondary plan may not anticipate.
This is our next stop.
All right, we'll take the opportunity here to talk a little bit more about wetlands. On either side of the road here, we have pockets of the Mill Creek provincially significant wetland. On your right, it is still in a natural state, cattail wetland. On the right, or sorry, my left, your left, you will see something that's been modified a little bit more through development. Now, as I mentioned earlier, the wetlands...
One
wetland prior to the road being constructed. Now, that won't happen in the future because the wetlands are protected from development. We talked earlier about the importance of both these types of features in infiltrating water to the deep groundwater and to the aquifer that we draw our water supply from. The other important, of course, the wetlands have a lot of other important functions other than just water. They support a lot of wildlife, they support a lot of plants, and in fact, 20 regionally significant plant species were located in the study area, and almost all of those are associated with the wetlands.
So I mentioned water and Postage Township potentially locating a well on the south side of Maltby Road here. The city also has and does every 10 years puts out a water study. One of the wells they're proposing as a potential future well site is, we'll go right past it, it's the corner of Maltby and Victoria. So as we plan Clare Maltby, we would suggest as Protected Moraine that you should consider water. Guelph is the largest municipality in Canada that depends on groundwater for its drinking water. But there isn't a lot of consideration. If you look at the consultation document, there isn't any mention of water supplies. Right now, because industry and manufacturing sector has, and residential users have been using less water in Guelph, the usage in Guelph has flatlined. But if we're introducing 25,000, 30,000 people to Clare Maltby, we'll be looking for new water sources. So how do we plan Clare Maltby so that we're considering those future water sources is our question to the city. You need to establish source water protection planning, and the city does that. So there's a source water protection plan around the Burke Well, which is the closest well to Clare Maltby. The Burke Well is just off of Arkell Road on the south side between Gordon and Victoria. So there is lots of consideration around established wells. There's no protection for future wells, right? Because municipalities across Ontario get water from different sources. But we're suggesting there should be some leadership here around future water sources as well.
Near the eastern end of Maltby, Marcolongo pointed out where things have previously gotten out of hand with development in the South End, and we also traveled past the Rolling Hills area, which was taken out of the Claire Maltby secondary plan earlier this year.
So there's another road that goes through just over here, another north-south. It comes out just out here, and you'll see the different coloration on the map on the corner here, where they're suggesting employment lands. So where the building center is over here, it'll be employment lands. What's also interesting here, this wetland was also bisected, and this turn is quite challenging, and there's a lot of speculation that in the future the road will be realigned to accommodate traffic due to increase in volume when you have 20 or 25 or 30,000 residents living here. Just west of here, there's high density in here, and there's also a road that's going to come through this way. This land here is owned by Carson Reed, and in 2009, just ahead of the Natural Heritage Strategy, they went in and they brought in a logger buncher, or logger feller buncher, and they mowed down the plantation forest in the space of a week, some 60 acres. And they were charged by both the city and Environment Canada. Environment Canada through the Migratory Birds Act. Unfortunately, Environment Canada was only able to find one nest in that 60 acres that was damaged, so they were fined $100. The city charged them under the tree bylaw, and they were charged $10,000. That was 2009, still owned by Carson Reed at this point. We're also now traveling further north, just to our west again is the Rolling Hills subdivision. So these are 50 families that own quite expensive homes. It's very rural residential, and they made quite a fuss because they were included in the original boundaries of the Claire Maltby secondary plan, and the city was proposing that the road, the north-south road, goes right through their neighborhood, the city back in June decided to eliminate them from the secondary plan, so that removed about 300 acres from the secondary plan. The challenge here is that everybody's on individual wells and septic. The subdivision, because it's a rural subdivision, it does respect the kind of landscape and the contours, but it's very low density. And the city's running out of room, and so where do we expand is a key question.
We then returned to Claire Road on our way to the Markalongo Farm, past the Pergola Commons Plaza and all the new commercial development there. We also passed by another controversial development.
So we're going to move south down Gordon Street. This is the new commercial node, very successful in terms of attracting tenants. And it's expected to serve residents in this area in terms of a commercial convenience, in terms of amenities and so on. We're just going to travel a little south, and it'll be our left. You'll see a new development. It's 1888 Gordon Street, which was just approved in the last few months. It's the beginning of the condos that will move south. It's four 10-story condos, very high-end. It's Tricar, the same developer that built our downtown condos. And what's interesting here is it's a precedent for the city. Why? Not because it's a condo, but because we're going, typically with condos, there's an evolution, right? You go from, smaller to bigger and you intensify. In this case, we're going from significant lot with one home, mostly forested, it was plantation, and we're going high. We're going to 10, 12 stories from a natural state almost. I think it is challenging our notion of urbanity.
And finally, we get to our last stop on the tour, the Markalongo Farm itself, where our tour guide laid out his personal stake in the project and how the process so far for Claire Maltby has failed to meet the aspirational expectations set by the city and other plans and wanted by the people for this one.
Welcome to the Marco Longo farm. This is where I grew up. This is my mother, Assunta, over here.
Hi, mother.
So we're trying to do something really cool with the farm here. In terms of, there's some really neat heritage assets. This farm was established in 1832 by the Harrisons. Because you saw the land, the Perisgault Moraine, lot very rocky, very difficult land. They gave up within a couple of years, and they moved to Owen Sound. And if you know Harrison Park in Owen Sound, that's the same family, but they were much more successful with their lumber mill in Owen Sound. Following the Harrisons, the Beatties took over, and they established most of the buildings. And there's quite a stunning stone house there. In terms of leaving a legacy, we wanted to create the largest cultural heritage landscape designation in the history of the city, and one of the largest in the history of Ontario. And so we've been working with the city since 2007 to establish a cultural heritage landscape. So the landscape is protected through the Ontario Heritage Act. So as far as you can see in this area here, which is about 35 acres, we want to protect through a designation, as well as the buildings. And it's not the entire farm. The entire farm is about 106 acres. Between the heritage landscape and the natural heritage strategy, so there's wetlands back there, 55% of the land would be protected. There's 35 acres south of this property that we are an option with Options for Homes, who's an affordable housing developer. So we're trying to bring affordable housing to the city of Guelph. So the thing that's different here is you can see the rolling landscape, and it's very characteristic of the moraine landscape. So it would be the only kind of significant open space agricultural landscape that in the city of Guelph. And while it's owned by our foundation, it will be publicly accessible. So we're working on an easement right now with RARE, which is a non-for-profit out of Cambridge, on an easement agreement for protecting this landscape. But it's not over yet. Unfortunately, two of the developers on both sides of us, so there's Fusion Homes and through the Avila Group and Thomasfield Homes, are challenging the cultural heritage landscape designation. So they're taking us to a provincial tribunal and basically saying that this landscape is not significant to our community. It's essentially what they're arguing. So we're working with consultants, with our lawyers, to put up a fight at the Conservation Review Board at this point in time. As to why they would do it, we're not sure. What's in their interest, if this is protected or not. They certainly wanted to see the road. It would be cheaper servicing for them. But it's a curious challenge to us at this point. The challenge for us today and moving forward, and as we move from phase three to the completed plan, is what happens to the remaining 62% and whose values are reflected there? And so that's a conversation we're having. I grew up here because, you know, I grew up here and knowing that it wouldn't be ours one day. We're just stewards of the land. It's owned by our foundation, which supports developing rural physicians overseas. So we're selling 35 acres, two options for homes. That money's going towards a scholarship fund to help developing rural physicians with scholarships. So because there's no speculation in terms of our, you know, purpose here, we're able to do pretty cool stuff, right? The challenge is, as we move forward, how do we temper that speculation, or how do we build in such a way that does not reflect the ownership, that it reflects the values that we hold as citizens? So the reality is 85% of the land in Claremont is owned by home builders who have a particular view on things. But it's not necessarily our view, and that's why we're doing things like this tour. If you go to page 21, and full disclosure, I'm a policymaker for the provincial government. So when I see language like "will contribute" or "will strive," not "will lead" or "will propose a strategy" or "will work on a specific policy" or "will consider using development approvals process," when you hear those words, it's pretty wishy-washy, right? There's not a lot of leadership here. And so I encourage you to look at this because, you know, it's saying
the buildings will contribute to Claremont's sustainability goals. I don't know what the sustainability goals are. The plan is coming before the policies, and we're not seeing leadership from the city around green infrastructure or LID. Mm-hmm. Many cities have green streets policies. They have green roof policies. Toronto is a leader, for example, right? If we're going to mitigate the environmental impacts of development in the 62% up Claremont, what are those policies we're asking the city? When you look at the policies in the discussion paper related to priorities on transportation, I'll read it off to you. It starts off as Claremont will be a community where walking, cycling, and transit are attractive, not prioritized, right? This is a car-dominated secondary plan. Where is the aspirational here? We know where we're going in terms of climate change, in terms of densities, in terms of congestion, quality of life. Why would it not be prioritized, right? In the other secondary plans, the downtown, as well as the GID, Guelph Innovation District, significant new commercial, institutional, and residential developments shall be required to submit transit development plans or transit demand plans. The language is a lot stronger. Let's see. There's another one. GID, provide universal access that prioritizes pedestrians, cyclists, and transit users over drivers by providing an extensive pedestrian and cycling network. There's actual policies in the other secondary plans. Why are we being aspirational here? Why are we treating Claremont as a development application? This is about us and our city and what our values are.
Deputy Chief Administrative Officer Scott Stewart took part in the tour, and he offered some of his thoughts from the city's perspective near the end.
So a couple of thoughts, so I'm with the city and I'm here to help.
We're not going to link you.
There's a steep...
not at all. So listen, I've thoroughly enjoyed today, and we are listening, and I was really trying to just be quiet in the background so it doesn't feel like that I'm defensive in any way or we're not listening or there's a point and there's a counterpoint. And I'm going to ramble a little bit and then get to the very specifics of that question around the meeting. So, as I was listening today, Parks Dedication Bylaw is moving forward. So, yes, it's an old bylaw and it's out of date. And we're listening on that too, and we're moving that part forward. They don't directly report to me, but that staff are coming forward with changes to the Parkland Dedication Bylaw. I'd say the wildlife corridors is an important piece. And someone on the bus mentioned education. I wasn't sure who said that up front. But it's simple little things like our corridor up at Eastview. There's a camera in that, and that camera's on our website. Mm-hmm. And so for us, part of it is if you sort of love watching frogs and amphibians cross the street, then there it is. You can do that. But there's a broader discussion around education. And that's we've got to do so much more so that when we get to some of these other locations, it could make sense so that if you can imagine what it looks like in Alberta when you cross highways. It doesn't look like that on sort of the stops we had today. So maybe it should, maybe it shouldn't. But if you get through the education, you can get to those important pieces. The water supply, this is the largest municipality in Canada, this groundwater supply. You've got a lot of experts that work for you. And our engineering staff are quite competent. In fact, a lot of our discussion with the province has been, if you want expertise, you got to talk to us on this. And we've had some pushback on places to grow. We are the outer ring. We don't believe that we should be subject to a lot of the rules that sit within the inner ring, the GTAH. You can imagine sort of Guelph is on the outside reaches of Brampton and Mississauga and Milton. Yes, we don't have a big pipe and we haven't got any plans. There's no plans for us to tap into a lake. There's no plans for inner basin transfer. This is an important watershed for us as we sort of contemplate our future. So I'm glad to hear we're also talking about LIDs and other forms of sustainable engineering. So we're on for all of that discussion. You'll notice on this document, I'm getting there, I'm going to land a plane here in a minute. It says draft on here. Mm-hmm. We began this back in 2015, the summer of 2015, but there's a lot of work to do and people pay more attention as you get closer to it. And that, I think, is what Michael is also talking about here. So what's the details? So we've got a lot of details to work out. There's a lot of policy work that comes next. And yes, we will make sure that we land all of that. So whether it's next October or something after that, let's get it right. There's an opportunity to get it right collectively. Now, not everybody's going to love everything in it. I would say that, and I think you would recognize that too. And then the meeting on next week, this is the afternoon session. Thursday there was 43 people at it. Those numbers are higher. I wasn't in the office on Friday, or 43 in the evening and 20 odd in the afternoon. So if it's not enough, we'll have more. I mean, I look to that stuff and say, let's not fight over, well, I couldn't attend, therefore I'm mad. We want you to attend. We want your opinion. Make sure that you're on that list so that we're hearing your voice out, whether it's through the coalition that's here today or through Stacey Loughlin. She's our key contact. She'll meet with you individually as well. That's not an issue. That will happen as well, and she's been doing that with lots. But we won't. That's not a divide and conquer moment. We've got to record that stuff too, so that we're going to record it so that it's in these documents. And yes, it's important to know who the landowners, for sure. And there is lots of money to be made, but part of it is your staff should be neutral. And that's how we are, but that's how we should be seen as well. You know, for me, it really makes no never mind who the landowner is. You know, whether they're fantastic or horrible to deal with. What are our rules? What's the policies? And yes, we have to put roads in, and it upsets some people, but you put them in so that you can remove them. And then when we remove them, we've done it because it's evidence-based decision-making. And so that when we end up at LPAT or some of these other places, we can defend that too. And it gets us off-site a little bit. We were off-site a little bit this spring on sort of a road where it should go. And then we've got all the other factors. Like, you know, we haven't talked about affordability. Well, you've talked a little bit about affordability, so there's good leadership on that. But what does that look like, you know, here on the ground? What does that look like, excuse me, in terms of sort of alternate transportation or transportation demand management? Those are all factors for us. And yes, we'll have some density. Density can drive good things. Density is not all bad. Density is good for the environment as well, because it drives us with transit decision making. And transit's got to be part of all of this. And yes, it says four lanes, but what if two of those four lanes were just all about transit? So and cycling and walking and, you know, these urban villages. So I think our goals are likely a lot closer aligned. It's just a matter of how do we sit down together and trust one another. So that was a little bit rambly.
I'm sure you didn't want to pull me in for it.
It was 30 seconds. It turned into a lot more.
We're going to just end with a couple of thank yous. I want to first thank you guys for coming out, for participating. I think it's quite topical that, going back to the boathouse parking lot. If you grew up in the city in the 80s, you know why that's important. You maybe remember Bonnie McCollum. So Guelph had one of the first recycling programs in Ontario, and the bins where residents would take their stuff to the bins was in that boathouse parking lot. And so there's a long history of leadership, environmental leadership in the city. And so we're going back to our roots when we go back to that parking lot. I want to thank my mother and also Carol Koenig from the Nature Guelph, who funded the bus. So thank you very much. And thank you for taking us Sunday afternoon to spend the time with us.
Thank you.
And once again, that was the Discover Our Moraine tour. You can find all the materials developed so far for the Clare Maltby Secondary Plant at guelph.ca/clare-maltby. And you can stay up to date about any and all future consultations by emailing clare-maltby@guelph.ca. The city will be accepting feedback about the policy directions for Clare Maltby through January 2nd, and you can give your feedback at haveyoursay.guelph.ca. And that's all for this edition of the Guelph Politicast. The music for the Guelph Politicast comes from KPM Classics and Sid Dale. The host for the Guelph Politicast is Podbean. Go to guelphpoliticast.podbean.com to listen to past episodes, and while you're there, you can also listen to Open Sources Guelph. If you missed last Thursday's episode on CFRU, you can download it via the Politicast channel on Podbean. You can get in touch with me by email at adamadonaldson@gmail.com. Reach me through Twitter at adamadonaldson. Go to the Guelph Politico Facebook page at facebook.com/politicoguelph. And you can help build a locally sourced independent media outlet in the city of Guelph by donating to Guelph Politico. And you can find out how at guelphpolitico.ca/donate. For all the latest local political news, check out guelphpolitico.ca, where we will have a new episode of the Guelph Politicast for you shortly. And until then, see you next time.